Hello and welcome to the Thinking Poker Podcast. I'm Andrew Brokus. With me is Nate Mavis. And our guest today is...
We have no guest.
Shit, we forgot to schedule a guest.
No, we didn't. Actually, we had some logistical problems, and the choice was between no episode or a no guest episode. And we chose the no guest episode because we love our listeners and want to give them content.
But we can pretend that this is an 11th episode retrospective extravaganza.
Yes.
Because we do want to reflect a little bit on the first 10 episodes that we've had. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you, Nate, because part of the reason why we weren't able to hook up a guest this week is that you are going to be, or you have something pretty important that you're preparing for later this week that you need to focus on.
Yeah, that's right. I'm flying to Ithaca, New York for a few days to take a dissertation prospectus examination as part of my PhD. So big exam, big thing coming up, and yeah, I've been preparing pretty heavily for it.
So what does this mean exactly for your graduate student career?
So here's how things work. I'm doing a PhD in philosophy at Cornell. You know, you start, you go, you take courses for 2 years, then a third year you spend reading and studying and writing and studying and reading. Then in the fourth and fifth years, of course, you keep on researching actively and heavily, but you also define a dissertation project. And at the beginning of your last sort of chunk of graduate work, you defend your prospectus and some sample writing.
And that's where you are now.
And that's where I am now. And then eventually at the very end, I will defend the dissertation proper. So, yeah.
So you already have an idea, like even during that third year when you're doing your reading and researching, is that already on a certain topic? Like, you know, you're going to be doing your thesis in broadly some area, and it's just a matter of like coming up with a more concrete idea.
Yeah. And coming to a place in the literature and sort of in the conceptual space where you think you can make an original contribution. So I have a math background. I was a math major as an undergrad, and was originally interested in the way that metaphysics and geometry intersect in Plato. And then as I read more and more, I found that I was maybe even more interested in writing something just about the metaphysics, specifically in some of the late dialogues. So over the third year, my interest sort of shifted a little bit, and I'm using the math more kind of as a way into to just the metaphysics.
So now you've come up with the argument that you want to make, and you've got to sit down in front of a group of people who already have PhDs in this field, and essentially you have to like pass a battery of questions to assure them that you're capable of writing on this subject.
Yeah, that's right. So it'll be me and my committee, and it's three of them, and they're not only PhD holders, but all real experts in the field. And they will be examining me about my project and both specifically what I want to be doing and my overall knowledge of the subject. So it's also intended as like a constructive discussion. Like, explicitly part of the goal of this is for them to help me out and give me ideas and point the way forward, but it's also certainly an examination to test my competence and test the quality of my project.
Are they like actively trying to put you through the ringer? Like, are they going to be trying to like give you really tough questions and throw you off? Or is it more of like a formality and a constructive criticism sort of thing?
I wouldn't say it's a formality, but I don't expect to be too surprised by what they ask me. I don't think they're going to be trying to take me too far out of my comfort zone. I mean, part of this is because I actively try to put myself out of my own comfort zone as I study. So I try to have a broad competence, but it's more like they're trying to, I wouldn't say they're trying to throw me off. They are trying to test sort of how deeply and well I know my stuff, but
so they'll be rigorous, but not cruel.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And some of it is just, I mean, part of the goal of this is, again, to have sort of a constructive conversation. And then some of that is just path dependent. It's just where the conversation goes, like some of the stuff that they decide to ask me about. Another thing is that by this point, they're all very good sort of advisors and very generous with their time anyway. So they all have a pretty good sense of who I am and how good I am already. So they certainly want to examine me and they'll certainly learn things, but it's not like they don't already have a sense of who I am and what my strengths and weaknesses are already.
Is this more or less stressful than playing a $10,000 poker tournament?
More, I think. I think.
There's a lot more preparation involved, right?
Yeah.
I guess it's a lot more on you, too, if something goes wrong. Like in a 10K or any poker tournament, there's a fair chance you're just going to get unlucky versus here. If you screw up, I guess it's on you.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, as far as poker goes, I have a set of core skills that I'm comfortable with, and I'm always trying to get better, and I'm always learning things, and I certainly make mistakes, but I would never enter a $10,000 poker tournament if I hadn't spent a really long time honing my poker skills and feeling like I really have a plan and I really know what I'm doing and I'm really confident in that. But with a subject like ancient philosophy, there's the whole Greek language, there's all these texts, there's all this stuff, and it's just this enormous body of work and of knowledge that I have to have, and I'm competent in it. I'm ready for the exam, but it's just an overwhelming amount of stuff that I don't know, the sort of minimum set of skills that I need to be a good ancient philosopher feels like much larger than the minimum set of skills that I need to play a 10K tournament. So yeah, and for me, sort of nervousness is always tied to the relationship between how prepared I feel and
right.
how prepared sort of the ideal person would be in this situation, you know. So,
well, I'm wishing you well, and I'm sure the whole Thinking Poker community is as well. Although by the time they hear this, I suppose it'll be over. But
yeah, one way or the other, it'll be over. But no, it's good. It's I mean, one real nice thing is that Ithaca is beautiful, and as much as I love it here in Boston, there's the air is a little bit fresher up there in Ithaca. So
yeah, and Boston gets a little bleak in the winter, especially like after it snows. It's usually real dirty for a while. I guess you probably haven't had snow yet though, have you?
Yeah, we had one snowfall, but yeah, there's definitely that kind of urban bleakness, but there's a beauty to it. Yeah, I mean, today it's like a beautiful spring day outside, so don't need to worry about that yet.
Yeah, well, best of luck with that. I'm sure you'll do well, but I understand it's a nerve-wracking thing nonetheless.
I don't know, it's exciting. I mean, we should end the segment and go on to the next segment, but nobody gets a PhD in ancient philosophy unless he really loves it. So, you know, I love what I'm doing, and I wouldn't be devoting so much time to this if it weren't like an independent, you know, I'm excited to be doing it.
It's not the sort of thing you get into for the money.
No, certainly not. So anyway, dear listeners, that is why I am out of town for half the week and couldn't get an interview together and everything. So I hope the rest of this episode is payment enough.
Yeah. So let's you and I, and then hopefully we'll bring our listeners in on this conversation as well. Talk a little bit about the 10 episodes that we've done so far. Do you have a favorite out of the 10 we've done?
That's a good question. I mean, I think about the interviews first. I think this is something that both of us agree about, is that we love talking strategy, and that's great. But what's really exciting and cool for us is being able to talk to all these new people. And
yeah, I mean, I don't need to be on a podcast to talk strategy, but this has been an impetus for me to talk to a lot of cool people I wouldn't have had a chance to talk to otherwise.
And holy crap, we got to interview Tommy Angelo. I think that's right. One of our listener favorites, and that was a cool experience for me. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was I'm not prepared to call Tommy Angelo one of our best episodes just because it was so early in our podcasting career, which in a lot of ways was a good thing. I mean, he was a good person to have as one of our first guests. I'm sure it helped us to build an audience because that was a name that a lot of people recognized and they knew that he would have interesting things to say. And I guess it's really just a reason to get him back on the show again in the future. But just you always feel like there's so much you left on the table when you're talking to somebody as cool as Tommy that you wish you'd had a chance to talk to. And you know, probably we would have done a better job if we'd done the interview now with a few more hours of interviewing experience under our belts. But yeah, I mean, obviously that was a cool episode. And my only regret is that I wish we had been better up to the task. But you know, thankfully he's such a good guest that you're going to get interesting stuff from him no matter how shitty your questions are.
Yeah, that's right. I guess if you told me that the conflagration was coming and that I could only save one episode of the podcast to be preserved, I would probably pick Gareth's episode just because that got the closest to what I wanted to be doing with the show. Yeah, somebody who's using poker and living a poker life and not having wild success, but is getting what he bargained for and being in his own way sort of flourishing and successful.
Yeah, I've kind of thought of it of our, and most people overlap these categories to some extent, but I've thought of us as having sort of three categories of guests. One are sort of like the superstars, and I think Vanessa Selfs is the paradigmatic example of this one. And you know, of course, it's really cool to get people like that on the show and to have a chance to talk strategy or to talk poker, and everything we talked about with Vanessa is cool. And the drawback of those is that you don't necessarily get as intimate of a conversation. You know, you're catching up. People like that are very busy. They do a lot of these interviews, and no matter how gracious they are with their time, you don't, I don't feel like you get quite the same level of intimacy that you get when you're talking to someone who's who's not quite so big a deal. So when we get people like, you know, Leo Wolpert, who we just had on here, or Gareth Chandler, people who are very interesting and people who we know a lot. I mean, I know you're friends with Vanessa. I'd never met her before, but both of us knew Gareth, both of us knew Leo. And I think it makes for richer conversation when we have more time and we're able to get to a deeper level with those people.
Agreed. Although I do feel like I know some of those people at the IHOP in Barstow, California now, where Vanessa was calling us from. So,
and then the third category are people who just have kind of a unique take on the poker world. And I think that the best example of this is Matt Parvis, you know, where he's very influential, actually, in the poker world, possibly next to maybe Lee Jones, the most influential person we've had on the show, but he's not a celebrity in the sense that, at least before the letter files, a lot of people, myself included, didn't know his name. And I wouldn't quite call it an intimate conversation, although he was pretty open with us. But that's actually a kind of show I'd like to do more of, is just talking to people who come from a part of the poker world that is significant, but that we don't hear from directly. I mean, there's a ton of opportunities to hear from players. You can follow them on Twitter. You can read their blogs. There's all these interviews with them. The players are really high profile and with good reason. But I think there's a lot of other interesting people in the poker world. Matt's one example. Lee Jones is actually a decent example of this as well. Someone who's high profile, but not as a player. But I think it'll be interesting to talk to dealers, to cocktail waitresses, the cab drivers, the tournament directors, people who are involved in all these other aspects of the poker world who see the world, see the community, see the poker players themselves in a very different light. My guess is that they would have a lot of interesting things to say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess we should just say it specifically. There's a chance that some of these people are listening. Like, if you are listening to the show, if you are a dealer or a cocktail waitress or a tournament director or somebody who runs a sandwich shop across the street from a casino or something and has to deal with people late at night, we want to talk to you. Get in touch with us, podcast@thinkingpoker.net, and we want to have you on the show.
We're also curious to hear your to hear you answer some of the same questions that Nate and I just answered. You know, what was your favorite episode? What kinds of guests do you like? What makes an interesting guest for you? And if you have specific suggestions or non-specific suggestions of types of people or specific people that you'd like to hear us have on the show, we would really, really appreciate that kind of input.
Absolutely. We are only going to make content that we want to be making, of course, but we also want to be making content that people want. So tell us what you want. One obvious kind of question to ask is, for the strategy, do you prefer hand analysis or do you prefer sort of general discussion of position or general discussion of, you know, what get called soft skills or things like that?
Yeah, like, do you want to hear bigger picture concepts or do you want to hear us talk about one specific hand? Even if that specific hand, I mean, obviously we try to touch on bigger stuff, but I mean, would you rather hear us talk really thoroughly through one or two hands, as we've done like in the Leo episode, or would you rather hear us talk more broadly about how do you use position? How do you deal with aggressive three bettors? I mean, which of those is more interesting to you?
Yeah. So write in, tell us what you want. Thankfully, other people have already written in.
Podcast@thinkingpoker.net to send us those suggestions. And like Nate said, I mean, we obviously we're maintaining editorial control here, but there's a huge universe of people I think both he and I are interested in, of potential guests, and we're more or less equally interested in having all these all these different people on there. So how quickly we get to them, I mean, we could probably put together a list of 50 names, no problem, of people we'd like to have on the show. Yeah. And how quickly we get to them is mostly going to be a function of listener interest, and specifically the interests of the vocal listeners. There's been a lot of things on the show that we've done differently just because one or two people suggested it. And for all I know, there's 100 people who wish we hadn't done those things, but we didn't hear from those people. And we heard from one guy who said we should do something differently. So we did it. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, if you're vocal, there's a good chance that, you know, you're gonna hear us do something differently as a result of your suggestion.
Thankfully, the number of people who think the video poker coffee anecdote was charming outnumber the people who think that it was boring and annoying, as far as I know. So
yeah, but that's a good point. I mean, and that's a good bit of feedback to give us on this episode, because I mean, it would be possible in the future that we might do other episodes without guests, or there's always the question of, you know, what's the ratio of interview time to strategy segment time to just, you know, Nate and I talking time. And we have had conflicting feedback where some people have said, you guys seem interesting, I'd like to hear more of you, and other people saying, you know, all that stuff where you guys are just rambling in the beginning is boring, let's get to the guest.
Yeah.
So you know, what do you like to hear?
Yeah, although remember, if there are future no guest episodes, they will not feature 20-minute segments at the beginning where we're just asking people what they want. So use as your model, you know, what's going to come next.
One other idea that we haven't acted on yet, but that we've talked about doing is, you know, I do a lot of book reviews on my blog, but Nate is also a voracious reader and reads a lot of poker books, and I think we'd both be, you know, willing to read some books in the future. So, you know, would you be interested in hearing Nate and I, you know, talk about a recently published poker book on the show? Do essentially like a book review or break down a book a little bit, talk about what's in it, whether or not it's worth getting. Would you be interested in hearing that? It wouldn't be a weekly segment, but, you know, a thing that we did occasionally. And if so, you know, suggest some books. What book do you want to hear us talk about?
Yeah, that's right. And to be honest, that's something that we're probably going to talk about, at least in passing, whether people agitate for it or not, just because we're both very plugged into the poker literature world, I think. But speaking of that, the first poker book I ever bought, and, you know, I have all these great memories of sitting in a dorm room, reading it over and over and over and over again, and thinking about it and being so excited by all the possibilities that I was seeing, was Hold'em Excellence by Lou Krieger. And Lou passed away yesterday, 2 days ago, and I guess several days ago now by the time you're listening to it. And I didn't know him, but, you know, it's been touching to read all the very effusive and caring and very sad tributes to him over the last days. So we just want to say rest in peace to Lou Krieger and best wishes to everybody who's grieving the loss right now.
Yeah, and thanks for your contributions to poker literature, because they were early and important.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely still use a lot of stuff from that book in my poker thinking and in everything else in my life today. So definitely improved my life, and he'll be missed.
Other sad bit of news in the poker world, Danish pro Theo Jorgensen his home was robbed. You know, people came into his home and ended up shooting him in the leg as well. So I think the latest on him is that he is in stable condition. But this got me thinking, because, and I don't know if it's even been reported whether this robbery was in any way connected to poker. I mean, obviously there are some unsavory characters who you can encounter in the poker world or in a casino, and, you know, this is not the first incident of a high profile poker player being robbed in a pretty bad way. I mean, there was Greg Raymer. There are a couple guys at the Bellagio actually tried to, you know, kidnap him, essentially to bring him into a room, and he had to like fight them off and run away. There was Jonathan Duhamel being tied up in his home, beaten up, and had a bracelet and some cash stolen.
Yeah.
And
any number of follow home robberies and home game.
Oh, and David Sklansky.
Oh, really?
Yeah, David Sklansky was a victim of a home invasion robbery. I mean, people came into his house with a weapon and tied him up and stole stuff. That's he talks a bit about actually the strategy for dealing with a home invasion robbery in DUCY.
Yeah, there have also been a number of home game incidents recently. People, you know, home games getting robbed, and I think a lot of sort of minor casinos, I mean, everywhere really, have had problems with follow home robberies. So
yeah, I mean, is that ever anything that you were worried about when you were going to casinos? I mean, did you ever worry about, you know, were you looking over your shoulder when you left, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a big part of my plan, just because poker is not worth my health or my life, certainly. So in Ithaca, for example, there was a well-known home game that I refused to play in, just because if you Googled Ithaca poker game, this came up and here was the date and the time and the place. And I mean, any robber has Google also, right? And I just figured it was a matter of time before it got robbed. So I never went and played the game. And sure enough, last year it got robbed. I don't know exactly how it went down, but I'm certainly not going to go there.
Yeah, I had kind of a similar experience actually with an underground club in Chinatown in Boston. Back when I lived there, there was a place I had gone once or twice, and I, for one thing, I didn't enjoy it that much there anyway. It wasn't an especially high stakes game. It was kind of boring. They took a huge rake. I mean, it was soft, but it was still a little hard to show a profit because they took a huge rake, and you had to tip dealers well and whatnot.
Yeah.
But the security there was also not great, and it was. You know, it was robbed. I mean, thankfully not while I was there, but I mean, there was an incident of there was an incident of the whole place being robbed, and then there was also at least one incident of a player who was either coming or leaving from the game just, you know, being robbed outside of the place.
So when I lived in Arizona and I was a regular at Casino Arizona, first off, I want to say a retrospective thanks to all the staff there, because they generally knew what they were doing. The security staff was great, and they did a lot of little things that make players more secure. But one of my little mantras that I repeated to myself was that my session isn't over until I get home with the money without getting robbed. And that means getting a security escort to your car if you need to. I would always make sure nobody was following me on the highway. I would make sure that nobody was following me when I got off the highway, you know, just all these things. And again, I mean, the casino facilitated that, and that was one reason why I played there. But, I mean, follow home robberies are a thing, and, you know, not making yourself a target is also a thing. You know, get a safe deposit box if you need it, leave with chips instead of cash. Sometimes that can be a way to make yourself a little bit less of a target, a little bit. But just generally, you don't want to, you know, there's that DMX song where he says, if you're flashing it, you must not want it, right?
Yeah.
And just don't be the guy who's flashing it.
Yeah, even if you have a huge roll of hundreds that you're carrying in your pocket, you can and you're rebuying for $300, you can take the $300 out while it's still in your pocket. You don't have to take out a roll of $5,000 and peel off three bills.
Yeah.
And that is the sort of thing. I mean, it may sound like we're being a little bit paranoid here, and yeah, the odds of you being targeted are not that high, but the potential consequences are pretty high. I mean, not just that you're going to lose the cash on you, obviously, but much worse can happen to you. I mean, thankfully, I don't know of any cases. I'm sure it's happened, but I don't know of any real high-profile cases of poker players being killed. I mean, all the robberies that I mentioned, the people came out of it relatively okay. But you know, bad things can happen. So I think it's worth being a little bit paranoid. And for the most part, these are people who are looking for low hanging fruit. I mean, it's a different set of problems than a Greg Raymer has, where you're just you know, you're plastered as a millionaire all over newspapers all around the world. That's a different problem than the average poker player has. I mean, you mostly just need to not be the biggest target in the room.
Yeah.
And if which means, you know, not flashing cash, looking over your shoulder a little bit. As long as you're a little bit careful, I think that's enough to greatly reduce your odds of being targeted.
Yeah. First off, just a factual thing. I'm pretty sure I have a memory of somebody dying at a home game robbery a few years ago, but I also don't know all the details of that, and it's not clear exactly the chain of events that led to him getting killed. And second, yeah, I mean, put yourself into the shoes of the robber. I mean, who would you be targeting? Really, it's about making yourself, it's like choosing a secure password. If a really good hacker wants to get into your email account, he's probably going to do that. But your goal is to raise the cost of it. And I mean, one thing I do is when I go to the World Series every year, I bring shorts that have zippered pockets. You know, it's a simple thing, but, you know, try to carry around as little cash as I really need to and have my wallet in a pocket with a zipper. Now, of course, a good pickpocket can undo a zipper, but it's one thing that makes the cost of robbing me a little bit higher and the probability of success a little bit lower than the next guy.
I actually used to carry a fake wallet when I was in Chicago. When I was working in the Chicago public schools, I had to go to a lot of neighborhoods where there was a high incidence of crime in those neighborhoods. And I would carry one wallet. I actually had like a jacket with an inner layer that zipped into the outer shell. So I had like two jackets. So I would carry my actual wallet in the inner layer of my jacket. And in the outer layer, I had an old wallet with like, I had my student ID. You want to have a little cash in there. I mean, you don't want somebody to be angry if they end up with your wallet and there's nothing in there.
Yeah.
I had maybe like $40 in cash, enough that, you know, a person, that's about all someone robbing you on the streets in a poor neighborhood is expecting to get anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had $40 in cash in that wallet. I had a student ID. I had a couple of like, you know, just old, the kind of maybe a casino player's card, like the kind of like wallet detritus that you don't really care about that ends up in your wallet.
Yeah.
And then the actual important stuff, my driver's license, my social security card, like the kinds of things that are hard. Actually, I probably wasn't carrying my social security card at all, but the kinds of things that are hard or inconvenient to replace. I mean, I wasn't carrying a lot of cash generally, but I had that sort of stuff in my actual wallet in a pocket that was much harder to get to.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, I was prepared to give up. It didn't come up, but I was prepared to give up the outer wallet, and it would not have hurt me very much at all if I had to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely used the two wallet strategy. Yeah. I mean, of course, if push comes to shove, you're going to give him both wallets. And if he begins to suspect something, right. But definitely it makes a certain kind of robbery less painful to you.
Yeah. The one other thing I wanted to suggest was in terms of where you park in a casino, if in a security escort to the car is a good idea, especially again, if you've been in a high profile situation. I mean, if you win a tournament, if you hit a bad beat jackpot, something where like your name is being announced or a lot of people are looking at you and knowing that you have a lot of cash that day, that's a particularly good time to get a security escort. But just generally, you know, I'll try to park. You know, I might park on a higher level of the casino garage if it means I can park closer to the elevator, rather than parking on a lower level where it might be a little bit more. I'll have a shorter elevator ride or something, but then when I'm leaving the casino at night, I have to walk much further before I get to my car through a relatively empty parking garage. I think better to be close to the elevator so you can just, you know, get out of the elevator and straight into your car.
And I think people have fantasies about casino security. I'm not sure that that every part of every parking lot is under wonderful surveillance all the time. I definitely think you should be making a mental distinction between how secure you are inside a casino and how secure you are in a parking lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, good tips. So just, you know, protect yourself and don't do anything stupid, and certainly give up even your backup real wallet with the 10K in it if it's going to save your life.
Yeah, Jesus, we should say that. Don't fight over the money.
Yeah, I mean, really. So,
when you talk about negative EV wagers, I mean, risking your life for, I don't want to say any amount of money, but any amount of money you're likely to be carrying on you is pretty likely to be a negative EV wager. Don't fight back.
Yeah, but it's not clear what happened to Theo. I mean, I've read a bit that seems to suggest that he does a lot to make himself not a target. So certainly not accusing Theo of having done any of this wrong.
Yeah, no, I definitely don't mean to say. I mean, I think the more high profile you are, like I was saying with, you know, Greg Grammer having a separate set of problems. I mean, you can't. Yeah. There's nothing he can do to avoid being a target in that sense. I mean, his name is out there as a guy who has a lot of money, and that's just one of those rich people problems that I guess you. There's probably seminars for. In fact, I'm sure there are seminars for how to deal with those sorts of things if you're the kind of people who has to do that. I don't mean to suggest that it's the fault of any of these people who have been robbed. To give you some practical advice to our listeners, so keep yourself safe when you're at the casino.
Yeah.
Or when you're at a home game, and you know, maybe don't even go to the home game if they don't have good security.
Yeah, definitely. It's not that hard just to stay home. You know, it's like texting while you're driving or something, you know, like really visualize the bad outcomes and really try to estimate the probability and then really ask yourself if it's worth it to you.
Yeah, these are poker skills.
Exactly. So there's the sad and somber part of the show. Maybe we should get to some listener emails.
Yeah. So we've got, we're going to do a couple of mailbags today. This will be sort of in lieu of having a guest. We'll have a few writers, a few listeners who are proxy guests by virtue of emails that they've sent us.
They're here in spirit.
Our first question comes from a listener named Ben, and he's asking about game selection. Specifically, he says, I'm talking about online. I used to specialize and play exclusively heads-up cash games before Black Friday. Recently, I've been branching out, playing heads-up sit-and-goes, as well as six-max rush and ring games. I'm playing at varying stakes. This is something I used to do even when I specialized playing heads-up cash, with stakes from 50 NL all the way up to 400 NL. I'm a bit unsure about whether to continue playing a variety of formats or to stick with one. I'm tempted to use my results as an indicator for which are the most profitable, but I don't want to be results-oriented, and playing different games obviously means I have a smaller sample size for each. So I guess the question here is, should he be focusing on one type of game or one stake, or should he be trying to learn a variety of different games, a variety of different formats, maybe even a variety of different stakes?
Yeah, I think this is a good question, and my instinct has always been to do a bunch of things, learn a bunch of skills, and be able to sit in a lot of games. I mean, partly this is my live poker background. I mean, I've played a ton online, but a really important skill when you walk into a live casino is just being able to sit in the 20-40 stud game if that's the best game in the room. So I've always tried to have my specializations, but also just to be competent in just about everything so that if that's the game to be playing, I can go there, give up just a little bit to the experts, but be more than proficient enough to get all the dead money that I can.
I see the advantages of that, but I think I'm a little bit more in the specialized camp, you know, especially when you're getting started out or you feel like you haven't even come close to maxing out your potential in something. I think there's something to be said for specializing and getting good at one thing so that you can move up in stakes a bit. I mean, it sounds like Ben maybe is already there, but for other people, if it's kind of a matter of should I play a bunch of games all at small stakes or should I get into one game to the point where I can move up in stakes and be winning at somewhat higher stakes, assuming that the amount of money that you're making from poker is important to you, which I think it is for most people. But you know, if you're really just playing for fun, I think being able to play a lot of different things is probably the most fun. But to the extent that you're concerned about being able to make more money and having the best return on the amount of time that you invest in learning the game, I think it generally makes sense to put some thought into what you specialize in, right? Not just what's the most fun to you, because there really is an upper limit to the stakes at which you're going to be able to play a game like NLO8. It's just not a game that it's hard to find, especially like if you're interested in NLO8 sit and goes. They just don't go that often, especially if you're playing live. It's a hard game to find. So you want to make sure that the game you're investing in is a game that has a future to it and where you're going to be able, where there is room for you, something for you to grow into. But if you can do that, I do think it makes sense to specialize a little bit and to get good at one game. And the time when I tend to suggest for people to branch out is either if you have some reason to think that your game is dying or there's no longer a future there and the reasons you got into that game don't apply anymore. That's one reason. And then also it's probably going to happen at some point that you start to get burned out or frustrated. Maybe it's when you're experiencing a downswing or you're losing confidence in your regular game. I think one real good way of dealing with downswings, if you don't want to stop playing poker entirely, you probably shouldn't continue to play your regular game when you're frustrated. Maybe it's not interesting to you to play your regular game at stakes that are 10% of what you usually play. This might be a good time to learn a new game now. So if you're playing heads up sit and goes for a while and you move up from the $10 to the $20 to the $50 to the $100 level, and then you kind of hit a ceiling at the $100 level, you have some bad luck, you're not feeling as good about heads up sit and goes, you want to take a little break, this might be a good time to learn a different type of poker. And this way you're still in poker, you're still keeping your poker skills sharp, but you take a little time off from the game that you've been working on, you get a fresh perspective. And often this is something that'll, you know, if there were some things that you were doing badly, you're exercising some new poker muscles. And I think this can help to address whatever mental problems might have been affecting you in the game that you've been playing for a while.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think there's a lot to be said for everything you just suggested. Certainly specializing in something carries with it a lot of upside advantage that maybe being a generalist does not give you. I'm not sure that when you hit a ceiling in something is a good time to take a break from that, from a sort of not meta-rationality perspective. I mean, maybe it is a meta-rationality perspective. I mean, then you've got the failure, which is this great data for you to work with. So So, I mean, if you're moving up in something, that's when you feel like your skills are at a new peak, right? And when your knowledge is at a new peak, then you hit some kind of downswing, you hit some kind of failure. Then I think that that's a great time to, you know, get out your database, really look and see what caused the failure, because you wouldn't have moved up if your knowledge weren't at this really high level already, right? So it seems that it would be a shame to stop playing the game right when you have this wonderful combination of high knowledge and information of how this went against the toughest competition you've ever played. That seems to be precisely the time to work even harder on that one game. I don't know. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't mean to suggest that you would stop playing that game entirely. More that it just might be a good time to take a little break so that you can come back and analyze that data maybe with fresh eyes, rather than, I think, if you're trying to look at it at a time when you're already frustrated with the game, I think that you're not likely to be get the most out of that analysis is if you take a little bit of a break from that game, if you flex your poker muscles a little bit, exercise them in some new ways, come back, and then, you know, that data will still be there. It's not going to disappear. If you come back to it a little while later with a fresh perspective, I think you might learn more from looking over hands you've played recently than if you do it while you're still in that funk of a downswing.
Yeah, that's sensible. I would really make sure you have the data, though, and maybe take some notes about the sessions and so on, because everything you just said makes sense, but it would be a real shame if you at all degraded the quality of that learning opportunity, because it's one of the best you're going to get.
Cool. Thanks for the question, Ben. Next question comes from John. John says, I live in Los Angeles. I have a day job and long-term pursuits outside of poker. Recently, I've come to realize that I'm also in one of the more convenient locations to enjoy post-Black Friday play, with local casinos and a three-hour drive to Rosarito, Mexico. My day job offers enough flexibility that I could spend half my time in Mexico if I wanted to. One of my biggest post-Black Friday frustrations is losing the ability to use certain skills that I've worked on and invested in over the last few years. My current roommate is perplexed by my three dusty monitors and my douchebag computer glasses. In what ways can I take advantage of the opportunities I do have? My hang-ups include a relatively minuscule bankroll and general lack of practice since April 2011. Should I swallow the risk and vig of building a bankroll online in the current U.S. market, playing the U.S.-facing sites? Should I attempt to find a backer despite lack of practice and recent results? At what level would one have to compete to make reinvesting in poker profitable? Should I put my glasses back on, or is my poker investment fully depreciated?
This is a tough question. I'm not sure I could ever recommend in good faith to somebody whose bankroll is at a low point to make the investment to go to Mexico 3 days a week and grind it out there. Yeah, and those sorts of things. If you look at who's really making that work, it's generally people who could sink some money into it at the beginning. If it's a case where you feel like you've spent a long time building up the skill and it would be a shame to let it deteriorate, I mean, that's something I worry about. One option is to play like penny games on Lock or a European site and play sort of not for the profit, but just to keep your skills sharp and to actively use these pretty cool skills that you've spent a long time building up.
The point you make about the cost of going to Mexico, I think, is really significant. I mean, I don't know what exactly the market is like in Rosarito. I don't think it's particularly depressed. Like, I don't think rents there are absurdly cheap. I would think the cost, if you're driving back and forth from Los Angeles to Rosarito weekly, for instance, and you're also paying for an apartment in Rosarito, I mean, I would think that's costing you something like $1,000 a month, even if it's not a particularly nice apartment or anything. Yeah. So, I mean, if you're looking at $10,000 to $12,000 in overhead just to do this, that's more than, I mean, if you actually have that money, which you need to, I mean, I don't think you can go into this saying, like, you know, if you've only got $2,000 to your name and you're gonna get a place in Rosarito and start driving back and forth and hope that you're just, you know, gonna make enough money playing poker to pay that off. I don't think you can really do that. I mean, I think you need to have that $10,000 accounted for before you make this plan. In which case, you do have a bankroll to play a 1-2 or a 1-3 game at the LA casinos.
Yeah. You live in Los Angeles. I'm so jealous.
Yeah. I mean, I understand the point about not having a bankroll, but I think that's even more of a barrier to going to Mexico than it is to, I mean, even though you wouldn't need as much of a bankroll if you're just going to play $50 online games or you're going to play $10 sit and goes or something. I mean, you wouldn't need enough of a bankroll if you could do that from home. But once you factor in, in an extra $10,000 to $12,000 in living costs to do that, I think at that point you do have the bankroll to play even the smaller stakes live games, and that's probably what you ought to focus on doing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And like I said, you know, if the goal is to grow your bankroll and really financially succeed at poker, then sinking money into Mexico is not the thing to do when you have a small bankroll already. If the goal is to improve your poker skills, then so if the goals are financial, then grinding it out at the Commerce or, you know, going and playing at LA card rooms is probably a thing to do. Although see earlier about follow home robberies and keeping yourself safe and so on. If what he's really worried about is like he has all these multi-tabling skills and he has this, you know, online poker setup. I mean, again, those are different things. And I've spent a little bit of time playing the penny games on lock. They're not that easy. You know, you can definitely have fun playing online poker and really learn something if you're thinking about the penny games as you play those. So, you know, you might want to think about separating the goals first of financially succeeding at poker and second, keeping, you know, preserving this little online poker project that you have, which is a perfectly fine thing not to want to deteriorate, you know?
Yeah, I feel that's a good point. There's a real skill to beating weak players for the most possible. I mean, I think a lot of people might sort of chuckle at that comment, like the penny games aren't that easy or something. And I think that, yeah, I imagine any decent poker player is going to be able to sit down in a penny game and win. But if you really try to take it seriously and think about, you know, how are these people playing? How can I exploit their mistakes to the maximum? You know, that's a real poker skill that not everyone is going to do as well as anyone else. And yeah, the difference in terms of your EV is going to be measured in pennies, but it is a skill that is going to be very applicable, because I mean, those games may in a lot of ways play similarly to a 1-2 game at the Commerce.
Yeah.
So if you ever do find yourself having the opportunity to play that 1-2 game at the Commerce, having had the skill of figuring out what's the best way to take advantage of a really loose passive game where people are playing like the money doesn't matter, you know, that is essentially the same poker problem you're going to be faced with when you sit down in a small stakes game at Commerce or one of the other LA casinos.
I mean, yeah, exactly. It's not like I had trouble beating the penny games, but definitely, you know, the state of the world is just that there's not even that much open limping and so on that goes on. I mean, they play in a lot of ways just like really bad regs or something like that. you know, there's really something to beating it. And One skill that you need if you're going to succeed at poker is separating the game from the money. You know, you need to be able to move up to 10-20 no limit and just think about the game and not think about what $100 can buy you. But, you know, that kind of separating the game from the money, that works at both ends. You know, that works at pennies too.
And, yeah.
And you know, like trying to beat the penny games as much as you can is a good way to work on a lot of poker skills, including sort of focusing on the game all the time. Especially when I was doing this, I mean, the 2-cent, 4-cent no limit on lock was tougher consistently than the $2, $5 no limit at Turning Stone. So maybe I was playing one game at the wrong time and one game at the right time or something. But, and, you know, my sample in the lock games is not huge, but, you know, you can definitely, if what you want to do is play poker and think about poker and play poker in your underwear with an ice cream cone at your desk and not have to worry about it. If you want the online poker experience, go ahead, do it and play for pennies and think about it.
Yeah. The last part of his question I want to address is the question about, he says, should I swallow the risk and vig of building a bankroll online in the current US market and playing on the US facing sites? And I'm going to put a link to this in the show notes, because there's a real good post on Quantitative Poker, which is a blog that I like, written by a guy who really knows his math. And he essentially looks at he tries to quantify, depending on what assumptions you make about how safe your money is on those sites, he tries to quantify what is the effect on your expected value of, depending on how much money you have to keep on the site to play different types of games, what is the effect on the bankroll that you need, because you are going to have a higher risk of ruin when there's two ways you can lose, right? You can lose by, you know, through poor player bad luck at the tables, and then you could also potentially lose through your money just disappearing. So, you know, I'm not making any statements one way or the other about the legality of these sites or about how likely you are to get your money back if you put it on there. But I will say, I think it's something that you need to think about if you're going to play on those sites, and it's definitely a non-zero risk. So yeah, you do need a larger bankroll to play any given game on a site that's currently operating in the US market than you would have needed pre-Black Friday, when there was a much higher expectation that you were going to be able to get your money back off. If it can happen to PokerStars, it can happen to any of these sites. And you have to make your own decision about how likely you think it is to happen and how likely that site is to get your money back to you in the event that they do have to close their doors to the US market.
Especially if I were living in LA. I mean, the prospect of building a bankroll at low stakes live games in a casino is a little bit grim, but probably not as grim as trying to work it up from pennies on lock or things like that. So, I mean, this is an analysis that you're going to have to do, because I've never seriously considered getting into the, like, really trying to build a bankroll on lock after Black Friday. But if I had to guess, I wouldn't be surprised if you come to think that playing live is better for your bankroll, and playing online should serve other goals other than bankroll building.
Yeah. And, selling those extra monitors might give you a good start to a bankroll.
Yeah.
As depressing as it might be.
No, that's right. But hey, it's, think of it like cloud storage or something. I mean, you pay a rake, but you sell it, you can always buy another one later, just convert it to money for the time being. So
yeah, if you need liquid cash, you might want to liquidate and play those live games.
Yeah. When you were talking about quantitative poker, you were talking about Mike Stein, right?
Yes.
Yeah. He's awesome. I just want to give him a shout out. And he's a good person to follow on Twitter, Quant Poker. And I mean, I don't know him personally, but he's smart and a good Twitter citizen. And I'm glad he's in the poker world. So Mike Stein, Quant Poker.
Good luck to you, John. Our final question comes from Tom, who writes, "One area where I've been struggling to play optimally is dealing with big combo draws, when I should bet and raise them versus when I should check and call them. One recent hand example, this is from Parks Casino in Pennsylvania on a Saturday night 1-2 game. He says the first villain is under the gun plus one. He's got $290. He just sat down a few hands ago. The hero is in the hijack with $450. Hero has been at the table for an hour. He's won two smallish pots, and he won a decent pot showing down a flop straight, but he has a pretty solid image, hasn't gotten out of line. The second villain is on the button. He has $500, looks to be tight passive. He's been seeing a lot of flops, but he's mostly folded to aggression. He hasn't opened at all. He's just been limp calling or cold calling raises so far. So the hand here, villain one limps in under the gun plus one, three other limpers. Action comes around to hero in the hijack, and he raises to $15 with king queen of hearts. I think that's a pretty good size with the number of limpers in the pot.
Yes.
Villain two calls on the button. Villain one calls, and I guess the other limpers are folding because only the three of them see the flop. So $47 in the pot, and we get a queen of spades, seven of hearts, four of hearts flop. And the hero is holding king, queen of hearts. So hero has flopped top pair with a pretty good kicker and also with the flush draw. So we'll talk through the whole hand, but Tom's central question here is, how do you decide how aggressively to play a big combo draw, whether you should be betting or checking with them? The villain one does end up checking to the hero. So $47 in the pot. What do you think the hero ought to do with his top pair and flush draw?
I don't see any reason not to bet. And it'll depend how the action goes and also on some physical information, how fast to play it if I get raised. I think a bet like 25 should, accomplish a lot of the pot building goals that you want to accomplish, but also look plausibly like a continuation bet. So I would bet and evaluate. One thing is that you're out of position to one of the villains and in position to the other villain, and I would be, other things equal, a lot more inclined to play this fast out of position if it's not going to set up an awkward stack later. So I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think right now you can just treat this as a good hand that, that can get called by second best hands. So, I mean, people can have worse queens. People can have pocket pairs they're not going to fold. They can have straight draws. They can have other heart draws. I'd be even more inclined to play it fast if the other cards on the board were a little higher. I mean, I don't know how much these guys are going to have sevens or fours in their range. It was certainly like 8-7 suited, 7-6 suited. Those are plausible hands.
Yeah.
And the more aggressive your image is, like my image when I play in games like this, I'm going to get called by all kind of stuff. So the worse your image is, the more inclined you should be to bet. But I think there's enough second best hands that'll pay you off. And yeah, if you get raised, then there's a much bigger question of, do you want to continue playing the hand fast? But as long as you're still the one driving the action, I mean, your hand is plenty good enough to drive the action, and it's not so good that the deck is just crippled. Where if you had flopped a set of queens here, I might advise checking, just because it's pretty hard for your opponents to have much in the way of second best hands. But here, I don't think your hand is you don't have the deck quite that killed, and I just think there's a lot of value to be gotten by betting, and plus you should be betting a lot in this spot no matter what your cards are. So this, I think, is a hand that you might as well bet.
Yeah, that I certainly think is the case. You know, betting for pretty much every reason to bet is a reason to bet this game. So,
yeah. Our hero does bet. He bets $30 into a $47 pot, so roughly the amount that you're suggesting, Nate.
Yeah, that seems fine. I think
it's a good size.
Yeah.
Now, villain two, this is the guy who has not raised a hand preflop yet. Yeah. Villain two raises to $95. Villain one cold calls to $95 for more than a third of his stack. Action is back to the hero. $65 more for hero, and there's now like $270 in the pot.
Yeah, this is a tough spot. It's a bit hard to see villain two check cold calling with a set, just because with two guys in the hand, I think general sort of live play thought is, I don't want to let two people draw it on me on this draw heavy board. So on the one hand, it's pretty scary that he's willing to take that much action. On the other hand, it's a bit hard to see why he wouldn't want to put more action in now with a big hand. So he could definitely
I'm a lot more worried about the raiser than the caller.
Yeah. So I think that he would have a hand something like ace queen, possibly with the ace of hearts, a good heart draw, a combo draw, occasionally a hand like 7-4 suited, or something like that. I think the likeliest hands for the check cold caller are something like ace queen or the nut flush draw.
I think I'm leaning even more heavily towards the draws. I mean, with the fact that he could so easily put the rest of his stack in if he wanted to, there's two other people showing interest. There are a couple of draws out there. I do think slow playing is really unlikely. With any hand, any like made hand that he thinks is too good to fold, I think he's pretty likely to put the money in. I think with the fact that he's choosing to play this passively, even though he really doesn't have the right odds to call with any draw, I mean, I think you see a lot of loose players who are going to chase draws, especially like you say, a decent draw, like a nut flush draw or a combo draw. I think people are really likely to play those passively in a game like this and just to call with those, and to be much more likely to raise or fold with like a hand that where the board isn't likely to a hand whose strength isn't likely to change on future streets. Like yeah. The fact that he's calling rather than raising suggests that he's curious to see what the turn card is. And I guess there are some people who do that with like ace queen, where they want to see if the heart gets there before they put their money in. But I think the draw feels more likely to me.
Yeah, I think that's right. I do think that there are a lot of people who would just play ace queen like that and then say that, you know, they can't fold ace queen, but they don't want to put more money than they have to in the buyout. It's like, yeah, $95. Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, sure. I mean,
yeah, calling us a compromise, which is really bad, but people do it.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I don't mean to make fun of those people or whatever. I just think it's a sort of common pattern of thought that you see at the table is like, oh, I have ace queen.
I don't mean to make fun of them either, but I do want to emphasize, and I've actually written a whole article, an article with the title "Calling is Not a Compromise." I do want to emphasize calling is not a compromise, just because you don't feel comfortable. Like, if you don't feel comfortable putting your whole stack in there, you with your made hand, you probably shouldn't be putting a 30-year stack in there just to see what happens later.
But calling preflop is probably not the right thing to do. I mean, no, it's terrible, terrible, terrible poker play. Don't do it. So yeah. So what does villain two have? I mean, that's pretty scary, right? 95. That's kind of scary.
I think the raise here from a guy who's been so consistently passive is the more worrisome thing than the call for a third of a stack, because loose players do that without strong hands.
Yeah.
But the raise, I think, is much more worrisome.
I think at the time I would probably just ship it in here. And here's why. If he's if the read on him being very tight and cautious preflop is right, it's not clear that he would call before the flop with sevens or fours. So you can slightly discount some of the sets for that reason. And
I don't know if he said that he was tight. He just said he was passive. He said he had been seeing flops.
That's right. That's definitely right. But I think that some of those passive tendencies are correlated with a desire not to pay $15 to see a flop, whether you're the raiser or the caller. I mean, sometimes it's just passivity. Sometimes it's a desire to see flops cheaply. So I do think there's reason at least to slightly discount sevens and fours from his range, even though they're so deep, even though sets have value and all that. Another thing is that if he doesn't have a set, first off, you can't be in that bad a shape with the hand you have. And second, he might fold ace queen to a jam, which would be a boon for you. So between villain one usually not having you in bad shape and villain two being, you know, making a very strong play, but some of the strongest hands are discounted based on preflop, and he might actually, I mean, people, this sounds crazy, I'm not saying you should jam to make him fold a set, but he will sometimes fold 3-4s if he's that kind of person. I've seen it several times just in the last year. And so I think all the factors together point to this being a jam. What do you think of that?
I'm going to have to disagree with you. Okay. I'm not buying the fours and sevens discounted preflop.
Okay.
I mean, I won't say that there's no one in the world who would play that way, but I mean, based on the way here described this guy, you know, he says he's been seeing a fair number of flops. He's folded to any aggression. He hasn't been opening. He's just been limp calling and cold calling. I really see no reason to think this guy is folding fours or sevens preflop without a more specific read. So I'm perfectly comfortable saying that he has all combos of fours and sevens in his range. Yeah, there are people who will let go of hands as strong as bottom set after the flop when they have, you know, what feels like a big stack to them. And I shortened the guy's email a little bit, Tom's email, to read. He did actually describe villain two as someone he thought he might be a little scared of losing his entire stack. So that does go to your point of shoving to, you know, have an outside chance of making him fold a better hand. That said, I'm still pretty uncomfortable about the idea of trying to make really anyone, but certainly a 1-2 player, trying to make him let go of a hand as good, even as top pair, top kicker, let alone a set. So the way I look at this is, once you get raised on the flop, I think it's extremely unlikely that Hero has the best hand. That's the first thing I want to say. I think it's extremely unlikely Hero has the best hand. And I think that Hero has quite small fold equity. Hero does still have pretty good equity against villain's range. I mean, ace queen is, you have quite good equity against ace queen, 12 outs on ace queen, unless villain one has a flush draw, which is going to cut into your outs, possibly significantly if he has the ace eye flush draw. Actually, if you're here up against ace queen and the ace eye flush draw, you're in very bad shape.
Yes.
But I think that's a little too specific of a read to get on. And you know, there's also the possibility that villain one has a less good flush draw than yours.
Yes. Or he has the ace high flush draw and he'll fold it to a jam.
Yeah. And that would be an argument for shoving, actually. I mean, if you can knock the ace high flush draw out, I think that might actually be the best argument for shoving if you can get the guy off of an ace high flush draw. Cause that would really help you a lot. So that I think would come down to how confident you are in putting him on a draw. Cause if he does have a flush draw, the ASI one is definitely the most likely.
Yes.
If you think about the kinds of hands people are going to call with preflop, many people will call with any ace X suited preflop. Yes. They're not calling with any jack X suited preflop, and you've got the king and the queen accounted for.
Yes.
So if he does have a flush draw, he's more likely to have the ASI than any other flush draw.
Yes.
That, I think, is the best reason for jamming. If this was a heads-up pot against Villain 2, and I thought Villain 2's range was equally as strong, I would definitely not jam here. I don't think there's very much value in jamming into Villain 2. I think you're almost always beat. I think he's almost always calling. I'd much rather, at this point, I think you kind of have to treat your hand as a flush draw. And if you hit a king or a queen, maybe you reevaluate. But other than that, I'm treating it as a flush draw. I'm getting pretty good odds. The possibility of making Villain 1 fold a better flush draw really makes this a unique case. Like the fact that this is a three-way pot, you know, it's something specific to this hand, and it doesn't get as much of the broader concept of how to play these big draws.
Yeah, that's right. Although this isn't that uncommon in a live game, this sort of situation. I wouldn't jam against just Villain 2 either, but with Villain 1 in there, first off, juicing the pot, second off, slightly apt to fold the ace high flush draw, maybe, and third, maybe also apt to call with a hand like 7-8 or something like that, if he's, you know, or, I mean, that's a bit fanciful, but queen jack or something. I mean, you definitely see these things happen. So, I mean, it may sound inconsistent that I'm saying, oh, he might make these crazy folds and, oh, he might make these crazy calls. But really, sometimes you have to think like that because he just sat down. You don't know how he's going to play, you know, like the, all sorts of things could happen. So I think we agree that neither one of us would want to jam if it had gone bet, raise, fold. But now that it's gone bet, raise, cold call, I think I'm still advocating a jam just because, you know, even the worst case with this extra money in the pot, I don't see you having huge playing advantages on the turn. And I generally hate strategies advice that says close your eyes and jam because how bad can it be? But I mean, when you look at it, you're out of position to the stronger hand. Good things, both good folding things and good calling things from Villain 1 can happen if you jam now. And you do have a hand that's often going to have very good equity. And I think I still like a jam here.
Yeah, the talk of Villain 1 having the ASX, I mean, I really think that's by far the most likely good outcome for you. I think that, not that it's impossible, but I think that getting called by worse hands is relatively unlikely. Getting better hands to fold is relatively unlikely. Making him fold ASX of hearts seems by far the most likely to me of the good things that could happen. So the more confident you are putting Villain 1 on ASX of hearts, which I do think is going to be a pretty big part of his range based on the way, just based on the flop cold call, I think that's like the single hand that makes the most sense is ASX of hearts. And getting him to fold that would be pretty great for you. So I can see the merit of that. But yeah, the less confident we are in that, or if he's not involved in the hand, I think that just jamming into Villain 2 is a common mistake that people make with these big draws, is they tend to just say, well, how bad can my equity be? So I'll put it all in. And what you're doing there is you're
finding out exactly how bad your equity can be.
Yeah, exactly. you're also missing out on the opportunity to play well. You're like, there's, in this case here, is out of position, which is one reason to think he might not play as well as his opponent later in hand. So when you're in position, you should be less inclined to play your big draws fast. And also, this is also a case where Hero has a pretty good idea of what Villain 2's range is. Yeah. And once, like, obviously poker is easier when you know what your opponent's cards are. Yeah. So when you know you're getting the right immediate odds to chase a hand that you think is extremely likely to be good if you hit it against this guy, and you know that he has a strong hand, like, the prospects of you playing perfectly on future streets, even from out of position, are pretty good.
Yeah.
So the more that you have a real clearly defined idea of what your opponent's range is, and if you're in position, which helps you to define your opponent's range, then the more inclined you should be not to end the action immediately, but to keep playing on later streets.
Yes.
You know, that's the merit of having a draw, is you know, and when your opponent has a range that you can define, you know what he has, you know which cards are good for you, you know which cards are bad for him. This isn't really a good example, but there are some cases where there might be some opportunities later for you to bluff your opponent off a better hand if the board gets scary for him. Like, if you had 5-6 here, you might be able to represent hearts and get Villain, you know, then you'd have a much better chance of making Villain fold top pair or even a set. So you give yourself a lot more options by calling once you know what your opponent's range is, but, you know, you're essentially, by, if you just stick all the money in here, then you're missing out on the opportunity to use this very valuable information that you have about Villain's hand.
Yes, that's right. One other thing I want to say, and I'm not sure this applies here, is that you're allowed to fold these hands. and if you think you're not getting the right immediate odds, and if you also think that your implied odds are not great if you hit your hand, or you're going to fold the best hand sometimes or something like that, you know, you're allowed to fold these very pretty hands. I wouldn't do it here, but especially in some of these hypothetical scenarios where the pot's not as big, or the raise is bigger, or he's going to fold on the flush card a lot or not give you a lot of action, or you don't have the third guy juicing the pot. I do think that folding is an underrated option in these cases. I'm not saying you should do it often, but in the cases where you should fold, you can really save yourself from getting into a bad spot.
Yeah, the general way I want to answer the question about how to play big draws is that you shouldn't think of it in terms of how to play big draws. Like, there's a huge difference between types of big draws. There's a huge difference of, you know, what kind of action there is ahead of you. Like we were saying, on the, if it's just check to you on the flop, it's clearly a hand to fast play. Once you get raised, then you can't treat it as that strong of a hand anymore. So I don't know how helpful it is to just think of big draws as a category that should be played a certain way.
Yeah,
I just think you have to think through the situation and think, what can I accomplish by raising? And usually the things you're trying to accomplish by raising are either, can I get called by worse hands? Can I make better hands fold?
Yes.
And you have to think about those things. Then you also have to think about, what can I accomplish by calling? Will I have opportunities to make better decisions than my opponent on future streets? And this is the one place where I do think it's salient to think of big draws as a specific type of hand, is I think those, they're hands that play really, really, really well when you see more cards.
Yeah.
Especially the more clearly defined your opponent's hand is nice. But, you know, when you have a draw, you know which cards are good for you. You know which cards aren't good for you. And getting that extra information of knowing what the next card is really helps you to make decisions well. So I think that, you know, big draws are just hands that, that play well when you can see more cards.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, big draws are hands that often have more options available to them. It's really a shame to play, to have a strategy just for playing big draws, because those are some of the most flexible hands you have. So why make a plan to throw away the options that you so rarely get sometimes? You know, I mean, I've been in situations very close to this. I can think of hands where, you know, just change a few details and I've shoved, called, and folded, even, because I was pretty sure I was getting, I believe some of the old British people call this getting forked when you have the nut draw in one spot and a made hand in another spot. And it's not meant as a dirty entendre. It's meant,
I assumed it was.
No. It's meant as like, you know, two prongs getting you or something. It would be bad to go into this saying, oh, if I have a big draw, I'm going to do this. Not that this is what our correspondent is saying, but I think it's really telling that just change a couple details and I want to fold or call or raise in a spot like this. And I can distinctly remember hands where I've done all three.
Yeah, the short answer is think it through.
But good hand. And if
we're not done yet. We have more action here.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So in what actually happens here is the hero calls on the flop, which I don't think is bad. You know, I think we've talked a lot about it already, but I don't think calling is bad. I don't think shoving is like way better than calling.
No. I mean, I would prefer a shove, but I do think calling has a lot to recommend it.
So hero calls $65 more. There's $332 in the pot going into the turn. The turn card is the ace of diamonds. So the board now is queen of spades, seven hearts, four of hearts, and ace of diamonds on the turn. Villain one now open shoves for his last $170. So he wasn't willing to put the rest of his money in on the flop, but now he is on the turn. Wow. He shoves his last $170 in. Action is to hero. And I think that there's probably still another, like, I think hero has something like 370 left in his stack, somewhere in that neighborhood, or the 370 effective that's going to play with the button.
Yes.
Or maybe more like 320.
Yes. Well, 450 minus 95 minus 15, so 340.
All right, so we're actually, I mean, I think we have to think of this as we're making a $170 decision against villain one. We're quite possibly making a $340 decision against villain two. You
know, yeah.
I think that leverage effect is pretty strong here.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not sure villain two can be folding a lot of his hands here, and especially a lot of people hate the thought of calling $170 with just one pair in a big pot like this, but are happy to shove it in. I think this is very consistent, especially if I'm deferring a bit to your judgment that he was really likely to have ace X of hearts on the flop. I think this open shove on the turn is a very common play you see with that. So I think that the overall line is even more consistent with the nut flush draw than the line up to the flop was. So
I will say it also seems kind of consistent with ace queen, where like, given your logic for why he might play ace queen this way on the flop, I think once he proves it to two pair on the turn, now he feels like he has a hand that he is comfortable. Like if he was calling as a compromise on the flop, now he has a hand he is comfortable getting in with, so he shoves.
Yes, no more compromising.
I think ace X of hearts or ace queen are probably his most likely hands here.
Yes, I think I would have to fold this hand on the turn. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, you're in. If he does have the ace X of hearts, you're in really bad shape. It's a good example of you find out just how bad your equity is if you say how bad can it be and stick it in.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you're in quite bad shape against him. And I still think, you know, in all likelihood, villain two has you beat, and you're not you know, even if you knew that you were ahead of villain one, I still don't know that you have the right odds just to chase you know, what may not even be a nine outer if villain two does have a set.
Yeah.
And you're drawing at a seven outer, I don't think you even have the right odds to chase against him, and it doesn't seem too likely that he's going to fold. So yeah, I think this is a bad case for you, where even though you've got a pretty good made hand and a pretty good draw, there's a fair chance that you're up against a better made hand and a better draw.
Yes.
In which case your draw is not really so big at all.
Yeah. Well, or you could just be stone dead. So
yeah.
What
actually happened is kind of surprising. So I'm a little unclear on this, but our correspondent here says that he did get it in with villain one, and he doesn't say anything more about villain two, which seems like villain two actually folded. That's quite surprising.
See, and that's actually a little bit less surprising to me. And this gets back to the flop decision, where our correspondent looks like a very acute observer and all that, but you only have so much information on somebody. And I think it's just a mistake to say that this guy has to have a much better hand every single time if he's raising you to $95 now. I mean, I am surprised that he folded on the turn, but I think this also gets back to my reasons for why I want to shove the flop, just because you can't trust somebody to have a better hand every single time, or even.
Yeah. I've got a little egg on my face from this one. Cause it's quite surprising to me to see the turn fold. But villain one does have ace hearts, 10 hearts, and that has our hero in quite bad shape. He's drawing out a five outer and he does not get there.
Yeah. For whatever reason, when this happens, I always think of that line from The Big Lebowski, you are entering a world of pain. Our correspondent unwittingly entered a world of pain and did not get there. So, but that said, I mean, if the other guy folded on the turn, there are worse things than putting $170 into this huge pot with king, queen of hearts if the guy behind you is folding. Of course, I'm gerrymandering the information to make this favorable to... I mean, I would definitely fold this, and I don't think this is a good call, but...
What about when you add in the extra equity of getting on the Thinking Poker podcast?
Yeah, it is. Yes. So if this happens to you, if you think you make a bad call, email the show about it. You might recoup some of the emotional loss that you got. So
thanks for the hand, Tom. I do think it was a good hand. It was a good question. It's a topic that we've talked a little bit on the podcast before, but I don't think in the context of a specific hand. So it was good to have a specific hand to talk about. And sorry for your loss.
But nice hand. I don't know. I do like the way he's thinking. I mean, I think you're right that his project of finding a way to play his big hands might not be the best way to think about it. But certainly I like some of the observational things that he's doing. I mean, I guess I dislike two big decisions he made in this hand, but I also think he's doing a lot right here.
Yeah, and I do think that, I was a little glib in saying you don't want to think about them as like a discrete category, but I do think that these types of hands are some of the most useful to analyze, precisely because you have so many options. There's so many different ways that you can play them. I think that if you go back through your database, or if you know, when you're playing live poker, if you pay particular attention to spots where you have these kinds of really flexible hands with a lot of options, I do think they produce some of the best discussion. And they're the ones where, because you have the most options, I think you have the most to gain from reflecting on them and from comparing all of your different options. Cause it's just really fertile ground for analysis.
But especially if you're a live player, I know for a while I was playing online mostly, and I would do a lot of analysis that was based on exactly 100 big blind stacks, because just so many of your hands when people are auto reloading take place at exactly 100 big blinds effective or pretty close to it. But when you're playing live, I mean, it looks like here you can buy in a little bit deeper, but then random people sit down for $87 also. So the stack size is going to fluctuate a lot more live, and you really want a flexible understanding of big draws to adjust to these, especially multi-way pots with all these different non-100 big blind stack sizes.
We're debuting a new segment called Where in the World is Gareth Chantler This Week? Our interview with Gareth proved to be one of our most popular, with good reason, I think. And if you've listened to that show, then you'll be glad to know that Gareth has been grinding hard since our interview, and he succeeded in getting up the bankroll he needed to leave Canada and move back to South America. None too soon, either, because winter is coming. Gareth published a great piece on the PokerStars blog called Borderline Gambling. If you haven't already, you really ought to go read that. It's about his experiences playing poker in a Colombian casino and a big pot that he lost there. Nate's busy preparing for his exam, but I'm going to check in with Gareth now and see where he is and what he's up to. Has the bankroll recovered at all from that hit that you took in the Colombian casino?
I actually ended up bouncing back in the session.
Oh, that same session?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. It was kind of wild because everyone was playing like 25 to 50 big blinds. So I think I didn't make a river decision, basically, the session. You know, like all the substantial hands that I played were resulted in all-ins at some point. So it was kind of wild. But I only ended up down 90 bucks. So, you know, 9 big blinds at 5-10. That's, you know, that was a very happy result.
Yeah, especially after taking a hit like the one that you took.
Yeah, right off the bat. So, yeah, it wasn't all bad.
Well, and you got a great article out of it too. I really enjoyed reading that.
Yeah, I'm glad it's gone over well, and I'm slated to write another. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, should be good.
How was the rest of your time in Colombia?
Just the best. unreal. I mean, I didn't really do anything too crazy or anything. You know, I didn't go into the jungle or go skydiving or anything. But I don't know. It's just nice to get back to South America, to be honest, and be exploring a new city. I really enjoyed Bogota.
What's Bogota like?
It's in the Andes, so it's a bit high altitude, and there's a lot of things that I recognized from Peru, from Cusco. So I guess, you know, there's Spanish architecture from the 17th century, I guess it is. I mean, I'm not a total expert on it, but, you know, I can recognize it when I see it. There is a lot of people there. There's like 10 million people there. So
I didn't realize it was that big of a city.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, I was working up until the day I left, so I really didn't even look into anything before I landed or... You know, when I was like on the plane, I was looking through the guidebook of, oh, so, like, this is in this city. So, when I read 10 million, I was like, oh, wow, like, this is going to be like one of the days I walked from the old city to a district called Zona de la Rosa, which is like the pink district, I guess. And it's more of the commercialized, I don't know, area, I guess. And I think it took me like 2.5 hours to walk. It was like 10 kilometers or something, and you know, I didn't even do the length of the city north to south, like the length of the downtown core. Like it's that big. It's really big city.
Yeah, that's crazy. So, I mean, is it kind of like Mexico City, where there's a lot of or the pretty sharp contrast between the rich and the poor?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's, I mean, I haven't been to a city in South America where that's not true. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely, that neighborhood that is very open in that, like, all the houses are either like adobe brick or some kind of shack. And, you know, you can go up and like knock on people's doors or whatever, or you know, climbing through their window, like it's not too secure. And those are typically built like on the side of mountains, you know. And usually, actually, in I think in most of the South American cities I've been to, you know, the threat of mudslides is pretty serious. And then, or in contrast, the richer parts of town, you cannot actually go up and knock on someone's door. Like, everything is walled in, and there's like a gated area before the front door even. So
so
that's the basic distinction, I would say. And there's definitely pretty clear areas where you're in one and not the other.
And I mean, I'm assuming those places are roped off or cordoned off primarily for security reasons.
It's funny, like in a lot of Lima, but the place I noticed it most was in Cusco. People just have like high adobe walls, and then there's barbed wire over the top, or sometimes they'll have like beer bottles smashed up and then
mixed into the adobo.
On the top, yeah, right. Just like a weird. You don't want to climb over, I guess.
right.
But it all looks kind of grim, you know. There's like nothing. There's nothing showy about the places. You know, typically you'd think rich people, you know, want to show off that they're rich and wealthy. But it's kind of not the case just with the frontage of people's homes. Because I always thought, wow, Cusco really is, you know, this poor, destitute place. And then I actually met people who, like, let me inside. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, there are, like, some well-to-do people here. Because, yeah, some of the places inside the walls are, you know, it's, you know, first world or whatever. Nothing you would not find in the States. Yeah. So
Nate and I were just talking about how poker players ought to try to keep a low profile about cash they're carrying on them and that sort of thing. So I guess it's a similar principle at work there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's, that's basically what's going on. I mean, rich people in Peru still have plenty of ways to be ostentatious, and they just don't, you know, exercise that one.
Right. And you, you mentioned the FARC no longer has their policy of kidnapping people. did you feel at all unsafe walking around, or did you feel like you weren't really a target?
No, I felt totally safe in Colombia. In Cartagena, I was very much in the tourist areas, I never felt. I mean, I was walking on the beach, you know, just by myself with nothing. Mm-hmm. I left all my stuff at the places I stayed.
And that's a safe thing to do, to leave your stuff in the hostel?
Yeah. Yeah. Some places, actually, it depends. Like I stayed at a few different places. If you stay at a higher end place, they make you check your key with them. So they actually do have access to your room if they wanted to. If they wanted to go in and steal stuff from you, they could. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you're staying at a higher end place, you know, it's got brand name on the door, you know, like the people are trustworthy and reasonable, just like would be in any other first world country. If you stay in a shittier place, in a hovel that calls itself a hostel, usually like they'll give you a lock, like an actual lock to put on the door, and you take the key with you. So, you know, like it's, you're the only one who could actually get in. So, yeah, I mean, I never felt unsafe at all. Walking around Bogota, I felt fine. I mean, I do certain things, but like I dress the absolute bare minimum that I need to. So if I'm going to like a nice restaurant, I'll try and think what is the absolute worst thing I could wear to get away with, you know, with it. But most of the time I'm, you know, not in too nice of clothes.
What about at the casino? Are you concerned about people saying you're coming and go from there?
Yeah. So I'm kind of concerned with that to a degree. In Cartagena, I guess I had a lot of money going back and forth, but yeah, the neighborhood was fine. Like, it was a reasonable neighborhood, and I had like a 10-minute walk back to the place I was staying. So, You know, it's obviously going through my mind, but I didn't really assess like a high amount of risk. Yeah. So
what are you looking forward to now that you're back in Lima?
Well, I bought some clothes. That was good. bought some clothes and got a haircut. Honestly, I'm just looking forward to making Supernova in the next 3 weeks. And yeah, I think it's going to be like I'm just going to be playing and working and, you know, working out, taking care of myself.
You're on pace to hit Supernova?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm on pace. Excellent. So that should be good. It's going to be my first year where I actually make it. So I am looking forward to some $24 hour-long massages here in Lima. I had my first one yesterday, actually. So, yeah, very much looking forward to that.
Well, super. It sounds like things are going real well for you.
Yeah, it's been quite the turnaround in the past 4 months, I would say, through some good fortune and some hard work, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's real glad to hear, and we're looking forward to keeping up with your adventures.
Yeah, there will be forthcoming columns, and I might be taking, adding a new stop in Chile, just for the purpose of generating content. So, look for the column in the Poker Stars blog. I'm definitely going to be going out of my way to get some content.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Gareth.
Thanks, Andrew.
Enjoy your time.
By the way, I got the Order of Things reference in the previous podcast.
Of course, so. You did.
Just wanted to let you guys know.
All right, take care, guys.
Yep. See you later.
So that's our first solo show.
Yeah.
That went better. I was a little nervous, to be honest. personally, I've always thought that our guests were the best part of the show, and I wasn't sure how well it would go over with just the two of us talking. But I think, you know, we had to put a little more preparation into it than we sometimes do to make sure that we had good stuff to talk about. But this was fun. I wouldn't want to do it every week, but it was fun.
No, that's right. I'm glad you were willing to do this, because I do want to give our listeners something, and people seem to like the strategy. So that's something we can do even on a week when I've got some things going on in my non-poker life that and other logistical things prevent us from getting a guest on. So good show. Good show.
So we gave you a show when we didn't have to. We put some extra work into it. And what we want from you is feedback on the first 10 episodes, and I guess on this episode as well.
Yeah.
What do you like? Don't you like? What do you want to hear more of? Tell us.
Yes, absolutely. And if you're really feeling like it, jump over to iTunes, rate and review us there. Helps people find the show, helps us reach more people with the show. It's makes for a better show. It'll help you indirectly, and it'll definitely help us. So we'd appreciate it if you did that.
Yeah, even if you don't listen on iTunes, you can still go over there and just write a review, give us some stars.
Yeah.
Ideally 5.
But you know, follow your conscience, whatever you think it's actually worth. So
I imagine anyone who's listened all the way to the end of this episode is probably a fan.
Yeah, probably. It's
probably not a lot of casual listeners made it this far.
Thanks for listening. Have a good week, and we'll be back with a guest next week.